Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Three segments today, unusually. First, in moments, we'll hear from the former Republican Bruce Bartlett on the strange lingering appeal of supply-side economics. Then Ken Jacobs, chair of the UC Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education, will talk about the center's new report on public subsidies to low-wage employment. And then closing the show will be the South Carolina-based activist and writer Kevin Alexander Gray talking about racist police violence occasioned by the shooting death of Walter Scott. First, Bruce Bartlett. Bartlett got into politics as an economic staffer for several Republican congresspeople in the 1970s. He went on to the Reagan Treasury and then afterwards the conservative think tank world. He was fired from a think tank job and purged from the right for having dared to criticize George W. Bush. Since then, he's been relentlessly critical of the stupidity and cruelty of Republican politics. With all the Republican candidates for president praising Reagan and touting a reborn version of supply-side economics, here's Bruce Bartlett with some historical perspective. You and supply-side economics go back quite a long way, right? You were working with Jack Kemp when the thing burst on the scene?
About almost 40 years ago.
How did it come to be?
Do you want the long version or the short version?
How about the medium version?
I mean, the 1970s were a time economic distress for a lot of people. There was a lot of inflation. People were getting pushed up into higher tax brackets. We were suffering from stagflation. And an economist named Robert Mundell had the idea that the way to fix this was to have tight money plus tax cuts. And a guy named Jude Winiski, who was working at the Wall Street Journal, heard Mundell give this a speech in which he outlined this argument, and he thought this made a lot of sense, and eventually Jude brought this idea to Jack Kemp, a former football player, professional football player, who was a member of Congress, and he liked that idea too, and he introduced some legislation to have a big tax cut, and eventually Ronald Reagan endorsed it, and it was enacted into law in 1981.
And how does Arthur Laffer, he of the curve, fit into this?
Well, Laffer was a professor at the University of Chicago Business School, where Mundell was teaching, and he had an interest in the subject as well. And in 1974, Laffer was at a meeting with then White House Chief of Staff Donald Rumsfeld and Deputy Chief of Staff Dick Cheney, and he was trying to convince the Ford administration to adopt Mundell's idea, and they were saying, well, what do we do about the revenue loss? And he said, well, we're at the high end of this curve, and he drew this curve on a napkin that came to be called the Laffer curve, which shows that if the tax rates are so high, you get less revenue, and if you're in that zone, that range, you can cut rates and have no revenue loss. And this has come to be called the Laffer curve, and it's still animates Republicans to this day.
Now, of course, there's some truth to that. It's not, you can have tax rates that are so high that they destroy revenues either by destroying the economy or encouraging evasion or whatever. But the real question is where we are in that curve and what its precise shape will be.
Well, that's right, and to my knowledge, neither Laffer nor anybody else associated with supply-side economics has empirically estimated the Laffer curve. People who have, serious economists, have always concluded that the top rate could be significantly higher than the top rate that we have today before you got a situation where a further increase in rates would cause revenues to fall. But conservatives and Republicans always just dismiss all this, you know, with a wave of their hand, you know. It's because in their universe, we are always, every single tax is always on the high end of the Laffer curve. You will always get more revenues if you cut rates. And there are any number of Republicans who have repeatedly said over the years that all tax cuts pay for themselves, which is, you know, obviously rank nonsense.
And of course, top tax rates now are what, less than half what they were in the 70s, right? They were 70% back then. They're
top
under 30
now. 70% on unearned income until 1981. But I mean, think about this. I mean, we after the 1986 tax reform, we got the top rate down to 28%. Does anybody remember 1987 or 1988 or 1989 being booming years for the economy? No, of course not. They just always conveniently overlook that. Personally, I don't think that these people who say they believe in the Laffer curve actually do. I think it's just a trick to cut taxes. And then when revenues come in lower than expected, they're just shocked, you know, like Captain Renault in Casablanca. And they say, well, this means we just have to slash benefits for the poor. So the fact that the Laffer curve doesn't work isn't a glitch. It's a feature of their economic system, which is to always respond to every issue by saying we need to slash taxes for the rich, and if for some reason there's a budgetary problem, we must slash benefits for the poor. And they just rinse and repeat and do this over and over and over again.
Parenthetically, you work with Kemp for a while. How does he compare and contrast with the Republicans of today?
Well, Jack Kemp was always criticized by conservative Republicans and libertarians at the time because he never talked about spending cuts. In particular, he was quite supportive of welfare programs. He felt that it was the government's responsibility to help people. And so I think he would be quite appalled by the callousness and the harshness and the meanness of Republicans today. I wish he was still alive. I believe he died, I think, in 2005. I forget, but he's been gone for some time now.
And of course, he would have had nothing to do with the racism that so many Republicans traffic in.
Oh, absolutely not. He felt very, very strongly about that. He always said it was because he was a quarterback for the Buffalo Bills, among other things. And he said, look, you know, I'm standing there by myself with four or five immensely large black men in front of me who's the difference between me and death, because there's a bunch of other guys on the other side trying to kill me on every play. And I remember clearly he had in his office, he had a big poster of a photograph of a very, very large football player, I believe it was Ernie Ladd of the Kansas City Chiefs, who was just about ready to pounce on top of him and crush him into a pancake, and just as he was ready to throw the ball. And I think it always kept him grounded to remember that, you know, you can be throwing the game-winning pass 1 second and be flat on your back the second.
Okay, and back today, so what Republicans do we have who are flogging some sort of reincarnation of the supply-side cuts of the early 80s?
Well, they all are. There's not a single Republican, at least none running for president, who doesn't favor a massive, large tax cut. Rand Paul, for example, put out a tax reform plan the other day that would have a 17% flat rate and abolish the earned income tax credit, abolish all taxation of capital gains, and would, at a conservatively estimate, reduce revenues by about $700 billion per year. And simultaneously, he put forward a plan to have a balanced budget amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And he favors both of these with no apparent irony.
Well, he's implying enormous spending cuts then.
Either that or some Laffer curve nonsense, or I think a big part of this problem here is that there's just a complete and total lack of seriousness on the right side of the political spectrum. Nothing is ever subjected to research or analysis or data or facts. It's all about how deeply you care about the ideology, and the ideology is the government is always at fault, that there's no problem facing mankind, or at least facing Americans, that can't be fixed by slashing taxes, slashing budgets, slashing spending. And the more fervently people believe in these things, the more truth they assume is in the ideas being put forward. And I think a lot of this has to do with religious nonsense, where it's just all on faith. It's just all faith. No empirical analysis is ever necessary. No facts, no proof. It's just all, I feel really strongly about this, therefore it must be true.
Well, it's also music to the ears of their contributors.
Yes, I mean, there are some cynics out there who are just in this for themselves, but I think a lot of smart people who you would think these things through are just as brainwashed about this stuff as anybody else. And I think this is very important to understand, that there's a bubble within which all Republicans and conservatives live, where they get 100% of their information about everything from their own approved sources, such as Fox News, where every fact is massaged or explained in such a way that they can discount anything that conflicts with their worldview, and they're just repeatedly brainwashed, really, is the only word I can think of, to believe these things that are otherwise nonsensical. And it can only be really understood in religious terms. It's as if somebody is going to church and living in the church, you know, 24 hours a day, and they're simply being given, you know, sermon after sermon after sermon about these things, to where they have no knowledge or belief in anything other than what is the approved doctrine of that church.
I'm speaking with the renegade Republican economist and writer, Bruce Bartlett. And going back to the Reagan years, the revenues never really zoomed as Laffer claimed they would, but the Reagan people never projected or assumed that they would, did they?
No, this is a little bit of a misnomer. The administration, the Treasury Department, OMB, all put out numbers about the effect of the 1981 tax cut that all showed very substantial revenue losses. Now, it turned out that revenues fell even more than projected, but this was not supply-side mumbo-jumbo. It was simply an error of forecasting. You can go back and check the revenue estimates of the Reagan tax cut that were put out by the Congressional Budget Office, and they're identical. The problem was the 1981-82 recession was much deeper than expected, and more importantly, the recession and the tight Fed policy brought down inflation much more rapidly than anybody thought was possible. Keep in mind that taxes are assessed on nominal incomes. So if inflation raises GDP, nominal GDP, that will increase revenues the same as if real economic growth was higher, you see. So the fact that inflation came down so rapidly collapsed the tax base. And that's the main reason why revenues came in so much lower than expected. It was less a failure of supply-side economics than economic forecasting.
But then when the deficit swelled and there was enormous pressure on Reagan to yield some tax increases, he did not act like a contemporary Republican and actually agreed to some, right?
That's exactly correct. In 1982, not long after the tax cut took effect, Reagan approved something that came to be called the Tax Equity and Fiscal Responsibility Act of 1982, which was, I believe, the largest peacetime tax increase in American history. It raised federal revenues by 1% of GDP. Now, and Reagan went on to sign into law 10 additional major tax increases during his administration. Now, one of the interesting things that you see from liars such as Steve Moore at the Heritage Foundation is they will try to imply In fact, they will just come right out and say revenues were higher, and this was due to the Laffer curve effect. And they will, and if you tell them, no, you can't take credit for the higher revenues from legislated tax increases, they just ignore it and go on their business as if you said nothing. And Glenn Kessler at the Washington Post wrote an article the other day in which he pointed this fact out. But it never penetrates, never penetrates.
And Stephen Moore is still on the scene advising Republicans, isn't he?
Not only advising, his approval is enormously important. He's being courted by every Republican running for president so that they can say that Steve Moore is endorsing their candidacy, that he is their economic advisor, that he is in their corner, because, you know, this will bring forth, you know, a great deal of credibility in the Republican world, you know, where complete nincompoops and liars and charlatans are the most highly sought after advisors you can have.
And Reagan was also not shy about raising taxes when he was governor of California, right?
No, he raised taxes very, very substantially as governor, signed into law the largest tax increase in state government history, I believe, when he first took office in 1966. So he has a very long record of supporting tax increases, but he also has a very consistent record of giving speeches denouncing taxes. And so what people do is they look at his speeches and they just completely ignore what he actually did. And this is very, very common. As you know, libertarians love Thomas Jefferson, and they just completely ignore the fact that he enslaved his own children and things of this sort. It's just, look at what I say, don't look at what I do.
But it almost seems as if Reagan would have a very difficult time getting the Republican nomination in 2015.
Oh, it would be impossible. Raising taxes wasn't his only heresy. I mean, keep in mind that he strongly resisted sending troops into the Middle East, and when the barracks was destroyed in Lebanon, he pulled the few troops that he had sent in, pulled them right out again. He supported gun control. And many Republicans have said publicly that Reagan could not possibly get the nomination today.
Finally, what's your guess on what a large tax cut would do under the present economic circumstances?
It would lose a lot of revenue, but it would not increase economic growth. And we have proof of this because we had huge tax cuts during the Bush administration, the Bush 43 administration, I mean. And I'm still waiting for the Bush boom, which people like Larry Kudlow predicted year after year after year from Bush's tax cuts. They said, we're going to have a massive economic boom, and we never got it. I'm still waiting for it. So I think the problem is that we don't have a problem on the supply side of the economy. The problem is on the demand side. We need to increase demand. And tax cuts will do that to some extent, but not very much. They're not very powerful in getting people to spend money. You need to actually put money into people's pockets in such a way that they will be forced to spend it. That's why government spending on goods and services, infrastructure, things of that sort, would be the most powerful thing we could do to help the economy today.
That was Bruce Bartlett, the former Republican turned critic of the party, though he regularly assures us that he is not a Democrat. Let's take a musical break. Thank you. That was some of the first movement of Mozart's String Quartet No. 13, performed by the Hagen Quartet. And now, Ken Jacobs. Jacobs is the co-author of a report from the UC Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education, The High Public Cost of Low Wages, written along with Ian Perry and Jennifer McGillivray. It shows how government benefits make the entire low-wage sector possible. Ken Jacobs. Welcome. So it seems like there's a vast public subsidy for our low-wage economy, doesn't it?
That's right. When employers don't pay enough for people to survive and provide for their families, then they turn and rely on public assistance programs, and that's costing taxpayers about $153 billion every year.
I was quite amazed to learn that nearly three-quarters of the people who are enrolled in our major public assistance programs are part of working families. What are these programs? Tell us something about them.
So in this particular study, we just looked at four of the larger programs: Medicaid, Children's Health Insurance Program, Earned Income Tax Credit, TANF, the Temporary Aid to Needy Families, the cash assistance part of that, and food stamps. And that's right, three-quarters of the people who rely on those programs are in working families, and about 56% of the money spent on these programs goes to working families. And the thing that's really striking is when you start looking at particular low-wage occupations, that over half of fast food workers are in families that rely on public assistance programs, nearly half of home care workers and child care workers, and 25%, one quarter of part-time college faculty.
Yeah, that last one is quite surprising. I think most people are aware that fast food is very low paying, but a very large portion of the academic workforce is now working on virtually fast food wages.
That's right. These are people with master's degrees or PhDs. And we used to be in a world where most college faculty were full-time, tenured, paid well, and that is it's completely flipped. The majority are now adjuncts. People try to piece together jobs through multiple colleges, and the pay is low, and they don't receive benefits. So we have, yes, a quarter of part-time faculty on public assistance programs, and many earning well below $15 an hour.
What are the wage levels we're talking about here? I presume below 10 an hour?
In terms of the college faculty, I actually don't have that.
No, I mean the other workers, though.
I mean, in general, yeah, we're talking about people who are earning less than, it depends on the family size around what public program you'd be eligible for, but we're talking about generally people who are earning less than $10 an hour if they're single individuals, or 13 if it's a family of four.
And now, what about the distribution of the use of these programs? Which are the programs that have in heaviest use by low-wage workers?
Well, the largest is Medicaid and the Earned Income Tax Credit. Medicaid, by far the largest. But SNAP, overall, we've got 10 million individuals from working families who are, or 10 million families, working families who receive food stamps. So that is not small, 34 million Medicaid, 20 million Earned Income Tax Credit. And, of course, there's overlap between those.
Now, of course, I imagine there are some people who might hear this and say, well, that's partly the point of these programs. Bill Clinton used to talk about making work pay. This is, in some sense, way of making work pay, because these people are not entirely on the public dole. What would you respond to that?
Well, that's right. And these programs provide a very important safety net for both people who work and people who don't work. But for people who work and the wages are too low, this does provide a way for people to get by. And that's extremely important. The problem is when we have low-wage employers, and especially very large low-wage employers, fast food industry, Walmart, who effectively rely on these programs as a way to support their workforce. So when somebody in McDonald's complains that they're having trouble getting by, they're given information about how to enroll in public assistance programs rather than being given a living wage. And so these companies are effective, the programs are effectively subsidizing low-wage employers.
We're talking about, you just mentioned some names, these are very profitable large corporations. This is not the corner bodega that might not be able to pay any higher wages.
It would include the whole mix, but yes, there are a good number of low-wage workers who work for very large companies, and the companies could easily pay higher wages, and they don't. And that includes, when we think about the fast food industry, when we think about stores like Walmart and Target, under public pressure, pressure now. Both of those have just announced they're going to raise their wages a little bit, $9 this year, up to 10 next year. McDonald's announced they'll raise a dollar above minimum wage, but only for people who work directly in the stores run by McDonald's. So all of the fast food strikes and the Walmart organizing, the Walmart worker organizing, the Walmart strikes have brought some real attention to this issue. It's and having an impact. Again, you know, the movement in the fast food world at McDonald's is very small in terms of amount of wages and workers who will receive it, but the pressure is having an impact. And of course, all of that, what's happened from those campaigns has really pushed forward these higher minimum wage laws that we're seeing, which really does have a big impact on people's ability to get by and the degree to which they need to rely on public assistance programs.
And I know you haven't run the numbers, but wage increases that McDonald's and Walmart are talking about, will these be enough to change this picture substantially?
It changed the picture a little bit, but not much. I mean, again, in McDonald's, it's a dollar over minimum wage, and it only applies to a very small share of the workforce, only the ones who work directly for work for stores directly owned by McDonald's. Most of the stores are franchised. In the case of Walmart, it'll do a little bit more, but it won't change the picture overall. I mean, we need to make real change. We need to get those wages up higher. We're talking that, you know, the $12-$13 range really makes a difference.
I'm speaking with Ken Jacobs, chair of the UC Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education.
And you do a state-by-state breakdown of these things. Is there anything you can say about the geographic patterns of dependence upon the public sector to subsidize low-wage work?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of interesting in terms of there's nothing that jumped out as, you know, why certain states are very high in terms of working family share and other states are very low. Overall, you know, you go from as some of the higher states, you know, Texas, 67% are in working families, down to a few of them like West Virginia, 45%. I assume that's because unemployment is so much higher in West Virginia. But it's there's no big geographic trends that jumped out on this. This really is an issue all the way across the country. And I think this is really good data for states to have. The overall cost to states and just the three programs we analyzed that have a state share is $25 billion a year. In a state like California, it's $3.7 billion cost of these programs for working families. And some of my colleagues did an analysis. They looked at the Mark Leno's proposal for a $13 minimum wage in California and found that it would save the state about $600 million a year in Medicaid costs. So that's not a small amount of money. That's people who were eligible under the old Medicaid formulas where the state pays half the cost. Many of them would move into the new formulas where the cost is paid fully by the federal government, or into a health exchange where, again, it's the federal government picks up the cost. The feds, of course, save a similar amount of money in terms of reduced food stamp costs, so they still come out ahead. But overall, it would be real savings to the state.
And, of course, a lot of jurisdictions, states, and local governments love to extend tax breaks to companies to create jobs. Do they always think about the impact it might have on their spending?
This is something I think they really don't think about. And as you know, we've talked about this issue, and my colleagues have talked about it, and to legislators here, it's something that hasn't been a part of the discussion until recently around. When people think about raising the minimum wage, they think, okay, the state contracts a bunch of nonprofits and human service agencies and pays really low reimbursement rates, and those people can barely get by. So if you raise the minimum wage, you're going to have to pay more. And they think about the cost side of the budget. And they very rarely haven't really looked at the savings side of the budget. And I think that's an important part of the conversation. And we're seeing states now, like, for example, Connecticut is considering a fee on employers who pay low wages and don't provide benefits for, you know, very large employers. Other states are talking about similar things. A number of states have proposals for much higher minimum wage laws, $12 or more. So we're really beginning to see much more movement in the states in ways to raise the floor that would begin to address these kinds of issues.
And so you've hinted at this a couple of times. It would take a minimum wage in the order of about $12 really to change this picture substantially.
Any raise raise in the minimum wage has an effect. And so some of my colleagues did a paper looking at what would a 10-10 minimum wage do to food stamp utilization, and it would definitely save money. There's no question. So anything you do is going to makes a difference, but it starts making a much bigger difference when you get it up into that $12, $13 an hour range.
Of course, people will then counter that this is going to destroy jobs and be worse in the long run. What do you say to that?
They do say that. It just doesn't match any the empirical research. So there's been a massive amount of research now on the job impacts of higher minimum wage laws. And basically, you put it all together, and minimum wage increases of the size we've seen in the United States to date have had no measurable impact on employment. What you do see is declines in worker turnover, better worker performance, better customer service, and that all saves employers money. It absorbs about 15-20% of the cost. You also do get a small increase, one-time increase in prices, mainly in the restaurant industry, a little bit in the retail industry, but overall, when we looked at the proposed minimum wage law in Los Angeles, we found that overall at 13.25, it raised prices by about one half percent one time, and at $15 by little less than 1%. So it's a small price increase for a big impact on the workers who would receive the higher wages. The other part of this, of course, is when low-wage workers have money in their pockets, they make more money, they spend it. And that's good for the local economy, and low-wage workers tend to live in low-income neighborhoods, and they spend money in those small businesses in those low-income neighborhoods. So that's overall good for our economy. So the evidence there that raising wages would hurt employment just doesn't fit with the empirical research.
And you mentioned lower turnover, higher productivity from workers. So what's wrong with employers? Did they just not get this message? Are they so entrenched in their bad habits that they can't change their way of doing business?
Well, I think there's two things going on. One is there are different models for doing business. And we see firms like Costco do really well compared to Sam's Club. In-N-Out Burger is doing great, and they have a bit higher wage model and fresher food model. So those business models can work. But it's also true, when we look at this overall, the higher turnover, better productivity, better worker performance doesn't necessarily absorb all of the costs, right? The difference here is if you do a mandated wage increase, you raise the minimum wage, and all the competitors have to follow the same rules, that means that firms can actually raise prices a little bit. And so that allows them to continue to compete while paying better. So it's the market isn't going to correct this problem on its own. When we look at what's happened with the hollowing out of the middle class, the overall lowering of real wages in the United States, right? 70% of the population or the workforce in the U.S., wages have been stagnating or declining for the last 10 years. At the bottom end, for the last 25 years, that's not going to change without a change in policy.
This seems like yet another instance of the dependence of the private sector on the public sector, even though our public politics don't like to acknowledge that.
That is right. I mean, this is the public sector plays an essential role overall, and the private sector does like to reap the benefits without necessarily acknowledging the importance of what they're gaining. I mean, overall, here, most of us would say, you know, these public assistance programs really are it's a vital safety net in the country. And you know, I would argue we should have universal child care. We should have universal health care. This only becomes a problem when we have means-tested programs, and some companies are going in and paying low wages and using those programs as effectively as a subsidy, which helps drag wages down overall and puts them and hurts the better firm's competitive position. So that's where you really do need to combine these subsidy programs with creating a much stronger wage floor.
That was Ken Jacobs, chair of the UC Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education, and one of the authors of the center's report, The High Public Cost of Low Wages. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. And now on to the final segment. On the first Saturday in April, we learned of yet another police killing of an unarmed black man, this time Walter Scott in North Charleston, South Carolina. To give us some context on this killing, here's the activist and writer Kevin Alexander Gray, who lives in Columbia, South Carolina, and knows the territory well. So, North Charleston, what's it like? What kind of town is it?
Well, it is, if you consider Charleston and if you consider a lot of the cities around the country, it's a town where black folk have settled as Charleston has gentrified. You know, it used to be where many of the workers lived in Charleston around the places that they work. And as the Charleston became a tourist attraction, a big tourist attraction with slave tourism, a lot of folk have moved into that North Charleston area. People that moved to that area of the state moved to that North Charleston area. A lot of the people that come in from the counties, if you consider the history of the area, North Charleston is their metropolitan area. It's 47% black. Of course, everybody has probably read that statistic. The police department is 80% white. Working class, income range is pretty much what you'll see all across the country in black communities. In some of these black communities in the South, the income distribution among blacks is pretty, I'm looking for the word, I guess it's pretty tiered, but people still live amongst each other, as in, I live in Columbia in probably a working upper middle class, well, not ain't all that upper, but, you know, it's a working class neighborhood, but it's surrounded by a sea of poverty, and that's what you get in a lot of these communities.
And the police department, is it like normally violently racist or extraordinarily so?
Well, I mean, what is violently or extraordinarily racist? No one really knows because who keeps track anymore? I mentioned in a piece I wrote when I was a younger man doing a lot of police brutality work, the NAACP and the ACLU, but in particular the NAACP, would take those reports and at least have an idea how the police are operating in a community. That's not done as much as it was when I was coming up. So a lot of, you know, just to have that empirical data as to how the police are operating outside of the anecdotal stuff that you hear from people every day, I don't think that we have clear numbers. I was reading something I wrote back in the mid-90s when the drug war was really just starting to gear up, when you had the increase in SWAT teams. And I saw in a note, in a footnote, that at the time of the Rodney King beating, there were 46,000 unresolved cases of police abuse or brutality at the Justice Department. And so I don't know what those figures are now. I would be very interested to figure out how we could pull together that kind of information. What does the Justice Department have, and how do they rate these departments? But the big issue will be, as in Ferguson, there's a lot of funding of government through fees, fines, and code enforcement that poor people and people of color are now facing to pay the cost of government, and in some cases to pay the cost of gentrification.
The shooting of Walter Scott was seemed egregious, but perhaps only because it was caught on videotape. I mean, is this shocking behavior for cops?
No. I mean, we all know that cops lie and that some cops will brutalize people. Some cops go to the police department because they have a sense of, some of them have self-esteem problems, and they go to the police departments, and that badge gives them a sense of self-esteem and a sense of authority. And some police confuse they're having that badge and having the job of enforcing the peace, or to use their terms, enforcing the law. They believe they are the law, and they believe that you have to follow it's not necessarily obeying the law, it's obeying their authority, and they lead with that. It's not about them serving you, it's that they believe that they are above the people And it's a police state mentality. You do what they say or else. The other reality is that, you know, the government makes us do what it makes us do at the point of a gun. If you don't pay your taxes, they send somebody to your, or they send a letter to your house. And if you ignore those letters long enough, they're going to send somebody to your house with a gun. If you miss a court date, they're going to send somebody to your house with a gun. You know, if you jaywalk, they're going to send somebody with a gun to say, if you jaywalk again, I got this gun on my side. I mean, government operates at the point of a gun. So it's not just rogue police, it's the mentality of government to, that it believes that in order to get the citizens to do what it wants them to do, then that, you know, unspoken yet obvious symbol of power is the gun.
Well, that's the definition of the state, right? The monopoly on the legitimate use of violence, as Weber said.
Absolutely. I mean, it is monopoly on violence. Now, the problem that the government has with laws like Stand Your Ground and with the culture that we have that people, a segment of people believe that they have the right to have a weapon and they have a right to have more weapons than the government, than the police, is the ultimate clash. I mean, you've got a lot of whites out here that when something like what happened with Walter Scott happens or what happens to Michael Brown, the first thing they're going to do is they're going to look at whatever fault that victim has, and they're going to say, see, they're inherently criminal, or you're going to see the most racist, vile comments in the comment sections of newspapers. And, you know, their racism leads their brain. It leads how they view the situation. But if the idea of a police state keeps growing and growing, the power of the police state keeps growing and growing, those people with the guns, how do they think that the state is going to deal with them and their guns? Right now, you know, you can have these young whites belonging to gun clubs with their AK-47 strapped on their shoulders, and when the police approach them, the first thing they're going to say is, I have a Second Amendment right to carry guns. No black person, of course, could do that. You walk down the street with a gun, just like I think they showed the film of that, and he might have been deranged, but it was a young man in Arizona that had a gun on his shoulder. Well, you know, they ran him over. There wasn't no questions asked. So all those people on the right, the racist right, that believe that what's happening to black folk, they deserve it. You know, if the state decides that they want to take those people's guns, that they want to challenge those people's Second Amendment, well, they better think long and hard about how that's going to happen and that blood that's going to run in the street. When I believe it was Ronald Reagan, when the right attacked Ronald Reagan after Waco, about those jackbooted thugs and the power of the ATF and the power of the DEA, people listened, and they backed off. But when it comes to unarmed black people, they just seem to think they get what they deserve. They need to, you know, for that so-called libertarian right, they need to look at, they need to be fair and need to be equal in how they view people with guns. Yeah, the racist, as I said, you're never going to convince a racist that black people are anything more than an animal.
We're listening to the South Carolina-based writer and activist Kevin Alexander Gray.
It does get down to this idea of the police state, to the number of guns and our gun mentality in this country, a country that's built on the legacy of violence, a country that believes in the use of violence from the top to the bottom. It doesn't just act out of revenge. It acts out of this idea of preemption. We're going to, you know, George Bush codified it. It acts out on this idea of assassination of its enemies. And people turn a blind eye to the fact that we're killing people without due process of law. So the country, over the last 30 years in particular, this idea of due process, bringing people in for charges, bringing them before court, an open court where people can see the charges that are laid against people, that's not the case anymore. It's about taking out a threat. The whole language of the police department is about taking out a threat. It's not about peace. It's not about dealing with the mentally ill in any kind of way that recognizes that mental illness is a condition, that it is real. It's just about eliminating the threat, and usually it's killing people with without due process. It's the police being judge, jury, and executioner. And, you know, that it can only end up getting worse unless we curtail it. There are people out there talking about taking up arms against the police, which is just crazy, because you're ending up being just as violent as those people that you accuse of being violent, especially if we're talking about, you know, having a peace is sustainable. And if we're talking about having a country that has a more peaceful future, then we ought to be talking about how we de-escalate the violence that we see in the country by the police, by internecine violence, and we've got to start talking about decreasing the violence that we export abroad. I mean, we're just a violent country. We're not the only way that we are exceptional is in the amount of violence that we've used in the course of our country's life, and those are the things that we really better start talking about if we want a sustainable future. If you want your children to have a future where they don't have to worry about walking down the street and the police or anybody coming up to them asking what's their purpose, and if you don't give them the right answer, being ready to deny you your due process right, their due process rights. We're in a very critical, serious time where we have to get take charge of the people who are supposed to be serving us, who are supposed to be protecting us, who are supposed to work for us.
Black Americans have long known how police do their work, with what violence they do their jobs. But the proliferation of, you know, video cameras and social media have made the non-black population far more aware of it than they had been before. Do you think this is going to have any political effect, or will they just shrug it off and make excuses?
Well, obviously, this idea, the police have adopted the idea of body cams, and you know, if you have a militarized police force, I mean, in which many of them have served in combat and they've already worn those cameras on their uniform, then, you know, it's not a big deal when you think about it for them to embrace the idea of body cameras. But they had a camera out there on Rodney King, what was that, 20-some years ago, and it seems to have only gotten worse. It's still going to take people being out in the street agitating and being in those meetings participating and supporting policies that de-escalate the police, that push back on the whole idea of the militarization of the police departments, that raise questions about hiring all these police officers out of the military that after they've been to combat duty and with that whole combat mentality when it comes to policing. And, you know, that's what it's going to take. Have a sign that says Black Lives Matter or racism, let's end racism and white supremacy now, but you still have to functionally change policies in a way that people can feel it. And you have to participate in government, and you do have to vote, and you have to vote people out of office who are not working in your interest. You have to look at who funds these politicians who support these policies that are criminalizing the community and empowering the police beyond the kind of power that they need to do their jobs. And we need to start putting economic pressure on the people that support these politicians and these policies. So it's, you know, it's the start of a movement. It's not a full-blown movement. All you've got people we got people who recognize the problems based on the video, but, you know, we still got a whole lot of work to do in reorganizing these communities. And, you know, as I said, it's got to go beyond the NAACP. It certainly has to go beyond this parachute leadership where so-called civil rights leaders parachute in to a problem, give a speech, and then give the names of the people who attend the speech to the feds. It's got to be more than that. It's got to be local people putting pressure on their local politicians that are and local people that understand that they are tied to a larger movement nationally.
Earlier, you're saying that this sort of behavior emerges out of the fact that this country is just so violent, has been from the beginning, and violent in every aspect, internally, externally, culturally, politically. It's just a very violent place. Where do you even start with that sort of thing?
Well, and the police were set up basically to round up runaway enslaved Africans and to control Africans. And so that's the foundation of the police in this country. And as I said, when you go back and just look at the police brutality cases that were uncovered after the Rodney King video emerged, the idea that police kill people, that they that official power is used to control people, as they did with the Voting Rights Act and that whole voting rights, civil rights struggle, none of this is new. All of us know that if we're caught, black, know that if we're caught in the wrong situation by ourselves, that the police will kill you, which has the same end consequence as a group of people lynching you. I mean, there is the comparison between lynching and police shootings. And when you see Walter Scott running and trying to get away from Officer Slager, it's in black folks' DNA to see that man as he's a fleeing African trying to flee from an overseer. You can see the terror of Swarner, Goodman, and Cheney trying to evade those Klansmen. That's what comes up in your mind when you see that footage. It's in our DNA, and that's the history of this country.
That was Kevin Alexander Gray, a writer and activist based in Columbia, South Carolina. He is one of the editors of Killing Trayvons, an anthology of American violence published by Counterpunch Books. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Divide and Conquer by Husker Du. Till next week, bye.
Lots of it.